Welcome to the Jerusalem Chamber, a collaborative effort between four friends and pastors who sit down to discuss the Westminster Confession of Faith. Let's join the discussion.
Westminster Confession of Faith, Chapter 24, Paragraph 2. Marriage was ordained for the mutual help of husband and wife, for the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue, and of the church with an holy seed, and for preventing of uncleanness.
Welcome to another episode of the Jerusalem Chamber. I'm Nathan Eshelman. Today I'm going to be sitting in Prolocutor Twiss's chair. I'm going to be leading the discussion, and joining me in the chamber today are Sean Anderson, Kyle Borg, and Joel Wood. Brothers, it's good to see your faces. It's good to see all those books in the background. If I zone out and feel as though I'm looking past you, I'm actually looking at your books to see what you have that I don't. So welcome.
Look at our eyes, Nate. Look at our eyes.
Welcome, and I look forward to our conversation today. Now, today we're going to be looking at chapter 24, paragraph 2 of the Confession of Faith, and we're going to continue our discussion on marriage, which we began last week. So this paragraph deals with the design for marriage for the comfort and improvement of the species. That's Shaw's words. Without getting into the paragraph just yet, how do you think today's Christian would answer the question, what are the purposes for which God designed marriage?
I think they would say companionship, first of all, and then probably something about, you know, reproduction or multiplying in the earth.
I'm not sure that a lot of people would even clarify it in that way. I think a lot of people are very dominated by a cultural influence of happiness that my even well-meaning Christians, and we'll get into the place of happiness, but I think they would see my personal happiness and enjoyment of another as really the purpose of marriage.
And just to keep it interesting, I think that most evangelical Christians would lean toward a theological answering of this question, speaking of Christ and the bride and picturing these things. I think culturally it's an uncomfortable topic of conversation, especially once you get into procreation and, you know, whether or not to have kids and how many kids and what if you can't have kids and these types of things. And so I think the evangelical mind is going to go in a more theological direction to answer, you know, the purpose of marriage is to picture Christ and his church, and will kind of just deflect a little bit from the extremely practical issues that are in this paragraph.
Joel, you must deal with much higher end evangelicals than I do. I wouldn't see
but
that.
You know, but
I'm not gonna be rude.
These answers are actually very interesting to me. I also think that, you know, was it Gary Thomas who wrote The Sacred Marriage? Is that a pretty influential book within evangelical mindedness? You know, the thesis of his book, if I remember it, I haven't read it in 15 years, but
it shows.
Marriage is not so much about our happiness as our holiness. And so I do think there would be a number of people who would put it in those terms as well. Like, well, it's about, you know, trying to sound a little pious in the way they view marriage. Well, it's about holiness. You know, it's not about happiness. And so I think even in the answers that have been given here, I think all of them are actually probably fair, and maybe one of the very reasons why this paragraph and its succinct answer is going to be very helpful.
I agree.
Yeah. So we have an order in the paragraph for the purposes of marriage. And I'm wondering if you guys, is there any historic ordering that this is following? And then is there any polemical component to the way that these are ordered in the paragraph? Sort of what's the psychology and the history behind this this ordering, if you see any?
Well, it's almost a human history of the opening chapters of Genesis, of as marriage is established, it's for that companionship, that helper. the mutual help. Then children came. Then there's the, you know, the within tucked in that family is the church originally. And then as the fall happens, then it becomes a mode of keeping one pure. So it does seem to have a historical outline to it based in what we read in Genesis.
It is also interesting, though, that if you think about chronological ordering, Genesis 1 is the language of the creation mandate, you know, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth. And I don't think be fruitful means mainly, you know, have children. I think it means be productive, but then multiply definitely means have children. But yet, when God says it's not good for man to be alone, and I'll make a helpmeet for him, I think that it's significant that they prioritize Genesis 2:18 over Genesis 1:28. In terms of, you know, companionship or help.
Kyle, you have any
mutual
any
help
on that?
Over the increase of
no, you know, the way you worded that, I don't know if this is a polemical point. I'm not sure exactly what I mean. They do move from the general to the specific. That's the ordering of this paragraph. It begins with, and we'll be getting into this either in this episode or future ones, that marriage is an ordinance for all of humanity. But then the confession shows itself sensitive, but specifically to the church, then here's the benefit of marriage. So I see that as the ordering. I don't know if that's polemical or trying to put anybody in their crosshairs.
Yeah, I was thinking about the fact that that the procreation aspect is not first. And in a medieval thought concerning marriage, procreation is really the highest purpose of marriage. And the fact that, you know, marriage is sort of, this is like a necessary evil so that we'll have children. And the Reformation comes along and says mutual help is a top priority. You know, the building of relationship here is a top priority. So I do see a reversal as far as what comes first. You know, the old Roman Catholic idea of procreation being primary, and then the symbols of our church come along and say mutual help is over procreation. I think that's interesting, and we could.
You're so smart. You must have a doctorate. Are you also getting a THM?
I mean, yeah, it really shows. I'm getting a THM in Kyle Borgism. So,
oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I'll be coming over
not much to learn there
to interview Rachel on what it's like to live with such a chiseled physique as Kyle Borg.
Rachel,
that ought to
be
a short conversation. Next.
All right. So before this devolves into flame. So the first reason that is given, as I mentioned, is mutual help of husband and wife. How do we know that this is God's intention for mutual help to be this first intention for?
Well, when we see
marriage,
the context, especially of Eve's creation, of course, those familiar with the opening chapters of Genesis note that as God pronounces his creation good, he sees that man is alone and that this is not good. And in exercising dominion, Adam names all the creatures. But there is not found among the creatures of God's good creation one who was a suitable helpmate. And so Eve is brought forth from the side of Adam. And she specifically is called the helpmate of her husband. But what I like about this paragraph is it does stress here the mutual help. Because there is something to the fact that God looks at Adam alone in this creation and recognizes this is not good. Man was not created to be a lone ranger, so to speak. He was not created simply to be a solitary being. God, in his creation, recognizes that this man needs community. He needs companionship. And out of that great need is where he then brings forth, by an act of creation, a suitable helpmate. And so it's not just that Adam is helpful to Eve. It is also that Eve is helpful to Adam. And there is a mutuality there, even though the wife in the order of creation is second. And even though she's the one that's designated the helpmate, yet there's this recognition in Scripture that it wasn't good for Adam to be alone. He wasn't created to just be that solitary being.
Well, you know, the Apostle Paul picks up on some of this too when he talks about, you know, that woman was made for man and man was made by woman. And so, again, there is this mutuality also that he identifies as he picks it up in 1 Corinthians 11 in terms of the relationship. And you can also see this idea of mutual help, even in the language of some say Moses' commentary that therefore a man is to leave his father and mother and to cleave unto his wife, cling unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And that's the most repeated statement about marriage in the Scriptures. And so there is this mutual, help that is seen in other passages, even beyond the one that Kyle cited.
Yeah, that's helpful. Kyle, you mentioned this a little bit, but the confession says mutual help of husband and wife. It doesn't just say that Eve is Adam's helpmeet. It says there's a mutuality in help. Is that an error in our confession? Is that, you know, sort of a slip of the tongue in the sense of giving too much to egalitarianism? Or is there something here that, you know, we should incorporate some into our thinking? You know, I don't know very many Christians that speak about a husband being the helpmeet. You know, like sometimes you'll hear a guy say, well, I'm glad that I've got the helpmeet that God has given me, you know, talking about the wife and the fact that, you know, he's barely functional without his wife. And yet you don't really hear that language, you know, wife to husband. This is, you know, like if a husband was introduced as the helpmeet of Mrs. So-and-so, that would be strange language to our mind. So here in the confession, when it says that there is mutual help of husband and wife, that phrase help coming from Genesis, the help meet for Adam, there's a mutuality there. Is that, you know, are we reading too much into that? Is that something we should revise? Is it something we should think about more further? Is it egalitarian? What are your thoughts on that?
It's not egalitarian, and I think it is something that we need to think about a little deeper. Anthony Hokema, in his book, Created in the Image of God, has a wonderful section where he speaks about the image of God not simply being something that we as individuals bear, but the very creation of Eve shows that there is this communal, this corporate aspect to the image of God. And he talks about how with the creation of Eve, Adam is actually able to reflect the image of God in a way that he couldn't as a solitary being. And so right there, you begin to have this idea that is the helpmate the title that Eve bears, that women bear in relation to their husbands? Well, yes, but there is this aspect where men need, they need women, they need wives. And part of that mutual help is the idea that together we reflect the image of God in a way that we cannot simply on our own. So that's one aspect I think of. I think there's more, but that's, I'll name that one.
Yeah, I think the idea of mutual here is picking up on the themes that flow from the Scripture. You know, mutual help in terms of duties to one another. And so we see when the Apostle Paul addresses husbands and wives, he has things to say to each of them in terms of their duties to each other, mutual fellowship, that there is a companionship, there is a partnership in all the things that have been identified, beyond even mutual help, and mutual help, even as each of them walk in their particular roles. And so that's the language of Scripture, is this idea of mutual. It's not egalitarian, as if to say that a husband can either walk in a can walk in any role, whether a husband or wife, or a wife or a woman can walk in any role, whether a wife or husband. That's more of the egalitarian sense, that there is no such thing as roles. There are no such things as duties to each other beyond the same duty to each other to love. The scriptures are actually talking about how that mutual help is seen in partnership.
Which I think is also really brought to the forefront in what the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11. So even as he maintains this creation order and he says, look, man was not made from woman, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11 that it was the woman who was created from and for man. And yet Paul goes on to say, nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Again, it's showing this mutuality. It's not just a one-way street. It is this interdependence upon one another. So I think the confession is drawing on that.
That mutuality is present from the beginning, from Genesis 2, in the language that is used there. I think, isn't it Matthew Henry's commentary where we find that language of she was not from the head of man that she should rule over him, or the foot of man that he should trample her, but from his side so that they can walk together. And I think there is, I don't understand why there is such a need among some supposedly reformed men to have such a dominance over women. I don't get it and don't understand it. This simple statement in the confession flies in the face of these guys who are just scared that a woman's going to take their lunch money and steal their chocolate milk.
Yeah, I think maybe we should write a book on the roles of husbands and wives. I mean, that would be totally uncontroversial if there was a book out talking about that. Okay, so
that sounds appealing.
Yeah, let's move on. So the second reason that the confession gives for marriage is the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue. So, behind that language is the growth of humanity required for prospering, required for dominion. How does marriage, even among non-Christians, help in God's call for humanity to have dominion?
Well, I'm not sure if it... how marriage helps in God's call for dominion, but certainly what we see in the mandate in general, I wouldn't say dominion exclusively, I guess, because the language is, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, have dominion over the animal kingdom. And so, these are things that do exist or flow out of marriage, whether believers or unbelievers. There is a productivity that we do see in the world, and when two come together, there can be a greater opportunity for productivity. Unbelievers have children, and so they're multiplying and they're filling the earth. There are many ways in which men and women participate in the work around the world, and if you see that work as part of the dominion aspect of the mandate, marriage has made it easier in some sense for people to walk in that working role. So. And that's not unique to Christians. It is something that's being done generically. I'm not speaking about the morality of it, but just the utility of it.
What's interesting to me, and I don't mean to hijack your seat as prolocutor, Nathan, but the confession recognizes, as the Bible, that we are to multiply, But how we multiply is something that matters. And the confession picks up on that with this language for the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue. How would you guys maybe explain that? You know, there are cultural crass words that we use to describe illegitimate children. But how would you emphasize that there is a priority scripturally and here in the confession that the goal is not just to have children, but legitimate children? Like, what are we getting at? And how would you talk to people?
Well, first we need to address the change in language and the change in understanding that in some sense is not well informed. There are people who will bristle at the term an illegitimate. They're not illegitimate. They're a real person. Nobody's saying they're not real people. You know, it reminds me of Denny Pruto talking to someone about RP worship. And they said, well, you don't believe in instruments. He said, yes, we believe in instruments. They exist. It's the same way. It's not illegitimate in that they're not an entire person. They're not made in the image of God. It's speaking of this very issue. It's speaking of children who come out of a legally binding, contractual, whatever language you want to use, relationship that is recognized by state, by church, etc., all of the laws of inheritance, all of these types of things flow into this. And one thing that we have to say, even someone who is, you know, against marriage as we understand it, etc., etc., life and issues of legality are so much simpler in a cohesive family generation to generation. I mean, and because of sin, there's enough, you know, wherever there's a will, there's a way. Well, wherever there's a will, there's a fight, usually, too, a family squabble. But it is so much more easily, things are denoted. Think of even tracing your genealogy. If you have multiple generations where people aren't married and nobody knows who the father is or, you know, things like this, everything is just so much more complicated. And generally, it's a blessing to mankind when the family is a cohesive unit and that reality is passed on from generation to generation. And I think that's some of what this is touching on in this paragraph. I would also issue a challenge to our listeners.
Legitimate issue.
To start from the beginning and go back and listen and give us the number of how many times Kyle Borg has said, I don't mean to hijack your role as prolocutor. And then you might be blessed by how he just goes on ahead and does it.
I'll include that in my PhD dissertation when it's finished. So.
Nice. I think that's a
good question. I'm done.
I think it's
a
good question, Kyle. No, I think it's important. I think it's very important what you're saying.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, Joel.
Cyber hug, Kyle.
I just want to add one thing to what Joel is saying. You know, not only is this demonstrated anecdotally and experientially, but statistically. I mean, this is the case. I mean, and we have a lot of statistics now where we can track the not only people being married or not married, but a lot of the results that flow out of such relationships or broken relationships. And so I think it's a very significant point.
And this is not pastorally, this is not to, you know, speak against someone has been adopted, they trace back and find their biological. That's not to speak against any of that. I just think it's speaking of that cohesiveness of society, which is interrupted. Adoption has been a great blessing to the cohesiveness of society as children have found homes where they are loved and cared for.
And that's also legitimate.
Exactly.
Right. It's the same in a sense.
Legitimate seed. Again, we're talking about children that are in a legally recognized relationship, and that is adoption, even more so. You know, the state acknowledges my children are born, but the law has a direct relationship with uniting parent with child in an adoptive situation.
Yeah, and one more point then to that too is, is that this is where the gospel is so significant, because it's true that there is a lot of brokenness in relationships. There are people who are born in illegitimate context, non-legal context, and yet that doesn't mean that in any way they're outside the reach of God's healing and even forgiveness for those who go against his word or even the light of nature as they, you know, are involved in relationships outside of marriage. So, you know, the Bible has a lot more to say about this than just simply the issue of legitimate issue.
Yeah. So connecting that, as I did, connecting it to dominion, you know, we see, Joel, you spoke some about this, but when families are not legally cohesive in that sense, there are all sorts of sociological problems that are associated with that. I mean, if you look at things, even things like wealth, education, health, those sorts of things, and you contrast
abuse.
Yeah, you contrast families that are, you know, mom and dad and kids, you know, family versus unmarried couple and children. The numbers are staggering. They're scary.
The research is in, and it just confirms this, right?
Yeah.
Like I think you'd be hard pressed to find research that testifies to the goodness of what, you know, of the opposite.
Yeah.
Non-cohesive families.
And that research is not a respecter of persons.
No.
It goes across the board on all ethnicities.
And it's not quote-unquote Christian research either. It's not Pew Charitable Trust or anything. It's like sociologists and psychologists and people that are looking at this, even secularly looking at it, and saying marriage is central to the building of a society. Kyle, I don't know if this is a problem in your county, but the small town that Sean and I grew up in, marriage is like hardly practiced at all among younger people. I mean, I have two siblings, neither of whom are married. Both of them have children. My brother has an adult child, and you know, they've never been married. And you know, that is the pattern that we see as culture breaks down, and God connects marriage so closely to dominion. And, you know, this might sound worldly, but even the success of society is connected to marriage. And it's very,
yep,
very important.
And I think this is a very important point, especially in the broader cultural conversation, because there's all kinds of people decrying what is called the idolatry of the nuclear family.
Yep.
And look, the fact is, it's not idolatry. This is God's design. You know, admitted by Christians and non-Christians alike, the family unit is the backbone of society's success.
Yeah. Like, and
I just
and even if you want to like throw off the Christian connection to marriage, if you want to be just a good old fashioned American pragmatist, if you want your children to succeed and to have the best possible ability to succeed, then marry the other parent. Simple as that. I mean, statistically, that is just a foundation.
I do think we also need to be really careful here. I mean, everything we're saying, I think, is right on. I totally agree with it. At the same time, you know, being in nuclear families does not give us a right to be self-righteous or to hold it over other people as well. I mean, some of these broken relationships at this point are multi-generational.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just want to say that, because I don't want any of our listeners to hear what we're saying and somehow feel that we're judging them or, you know, or just pushing on, you know, their experiences. I just want to say that.
Yeah. No, that's important pastorally, because we don't want to neglect those that are not in that. And, you know, I'm sure that all of your churches like mine have people that come from those situations, and some that are in those situations. And like you said earlier, Sean, the gospel does not put those out of reach. You know, there's covenantal hope for starting a new beginning in those things. So thank you for that. The third reason that the Confession of Faith gives is for the increase of the church with a holy seed, separating that from the family and dominion and children procreation that we saw earlier. We see that that marriage is really God's ordinary way of building the church. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
Well, this is Genesis language too. We hear the echoes of the first telling of the gospel. And so it is interesting that it delineates out legitimate issue and seed then within the church. There's redemptive Christ-centered language used in this context, that we're not just about having children, we're about raising up disciples within our home. And Nate, I think this goes back a little bit to your question about dominion in the previous question, where a family is one of the most direct and ongoing ways that a man and a woman can practice dominion in the world. These children are in your home, they're under your care, you are cultivating them, you're protecting them. This is all garden language from Genesis. And it's a very, very particular way that dominion is practiced and then multiplied as those children go out and take their place in the world and are gainfully employed and help provide for your retirement, hopefully. This is definitely Christ-centered, redemptive language applied to the children that are born, not just within a legally recognized marriage, but in a Christ-recognizing marriage as well. It's an issue of discipleship.
Yeah, and I think, you know, specifically, you think of the way that the prophet Malachi uses this imagery in Malachi chapter 2, where he actually says something rather startling, right? In Malachi 2:15, did he not make them one with a portion of the Spirit in their union? So we're looking back at that creation, you know, the man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, the two shall become one. And Malachi saying that oneness is accomplished by a portion of the Spirit in that union. And then Malachi in Malachi 2:15 says, and what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. So guard yourselves in your spirit and let none of you be faithless to the wife of his youth. We see at work there that principle that Joel was saying, God is not only concerned with legitimate issue, with legitimate offspring, but for those who are Christians, he is seeking a godly offspring. And there is tremendous responsibility then put on the shoulders, first and foremost, of the parents to raise their children in that way, and also the church to raise these children baptized as infants, as God commands, to be raised as godly offspring. But it is the way that God works to increase his people, is through the family unit. Wasn't it, didn't Ray Lanning and Joel Beakey write an article or a chapter in it's an otherwise pretty bad book, but by Gary Strawbridge on covenantal baptism. And in that chapter, if I recall, they trace out that household principle throughout all the scriptures with a special emphasis on the Psalms to just show this is how God ordinarily works, is through the raising of godly offspring.
Yeah, it is very ordinary church building, in a good sense. We should have a covenantal view of that. Do you men think it is wrong for Christians when they get married to say they don't want children?
I think it goes to motive. I think the motive has to be addressed.
What do you mean, Joel?
I think there are some, I mean, each of us knows one couple that both have severe physical and mental issues in themselves.
You talking about and you and Emily?
I told you not to name her.
Sorry, go ahead.
Looking at their, you know, their main ability is to care for one another and help meet each other's needs that way. And beyond that, it would be very questionable what their abilities would be. There are some who are fearful because of perceived mental health issues in the history of the family to pass those on as they understand it. Some it's just merely out of selfishness. We want to make a lot of money and, you know, the kids would impede that. And so that's why I think motive is very important. And that helps you address the real issue at stake, because it's, you know, it can look like you just hate children or you don't want to be inconvenienced. But sometimes there's some type of underlying motive that would cause someone to be that way. So I think of one couple that I married who, sitting in premarital counseling, they said, "We're not going to have kids. We're moving down south to the beach, and that's going to be our life." And there was a lot playing into that, from family dynamics and all of this. Well, now they live down the street from both of their families in the same town in which they lived when they made those statements, with, I think, 5 kids. You know, one of them a set of 20, you know. And so the Lord has a way of changing perspective sometimes. And I just think we need to be very careful in how we answer a question like this, because of what people are bringing into that marital relationship, their sure. understanding of it.
I think motive, discerning the motive, is of course very important. But I understand that providence may prohibit a couple from having children. I would be hard pressed personally to think of a holy motive to not have children. So yes, we need to address the motives, because that's going to be where the sin primarily lies. But I would be hard pressed to think through, here is a holy motive aimed at the glory of God, to be done out of faith, that would say, no, we don't want children. And I don't mean that to say then you don't interact pastorally with a person or get to the heart of an issue, but the institution of marriage for the purpose of having children is so woven into the very meaning of marriage. I think I'd be hard pressed to find a holy motive to not have children.
Sean, what?
Let me clarify something real kindly here, Nate. I don't mean to hijack your prolocutorship. Children is one of the reasons for marriage. And I think we misspeak to the issue when we say having children is the reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, nobody said it's that. Not because
you just said it.
And I said it's one. It's woven into, and it is, and you can't deny that.
I would encourage our listeners to rewind and listen to you say it. And I'm just saying this, Kyle. I don't think you actually believe that, but it's so easy to have that language fall out, and we're sending an incomplete message to people about this issue. It is one of the reasons for marriage.
Okay, hold on. I want to hear Sean. Just Sean, do you think it's wrong for Christians to say they don't want children when they get married?
Yeah. So I think this is a very delicate issue. I think that it is a theological issue, and it's also easily an emotional issue, and so we have to be careful. And I hear Joel's pastoral heart, and I hear the qualifications that are being made, especially, you know, that if people don't have children, it's not as if they are somehow less married. I think that's really important. But I do see it as, my view is, I do see it as one of the purposes of marriage. And more significantly than that, I will just say that I tend to fall in line with those who would see the use of birth control as for the purpose of not having children as immoral. There are other reasons to use birth control medically, but to prevent people to exist, or the prevention of potential people to exist, I personally have a problem with that. Not in a way that I impose it on those whom I shepherd, but this is my own view. And so I think that we have a responsibility to care for our sexual relationships within marriage, to abstain for seasons for different reasons. I think the Bible does give reasons for that, but I don't see anywhere where there's a language of husband and wife opening and closing the womb or having responsibility over the womb. That's God's domain. So, and I know I'm in the minority here, and again, I do appreciate the things that have been said, but that's where I would fall out.
Yeah, I think we're probably all close to the same place on this. Some of this is obviously extra confessional because we have to apply things pastorally and think through them and, you know, do that work. We have a doctrine of marriage here, and then we apply that in certain ways, and we may have some various nuances in that. I would agree that procreation is one of the reasons for marriage and therefore ought not to be separated from marriage as far as, you know, a starting point. I also, as Sean does, I counsel new couples that I'm counseling. I counsel them to investigate birth control and to encourage them not to use it. And because I do think that it is something that is connected to marriage. And I think that often, not always, I mean, Joel has given legitimate reasons, but I think often the selfishness of the Western world is the reason that we don't promote children as much as we ought in the church. So this is one of the reasons for marriage, part of our doctrine of marriage. The applications of that are going to vary, but I think that we need to be strong that this is a good thing. I mean, between the four of us, we have 20 children, and that's pretty awesome. And, you know, we talk about church growth and, you know, bringing people in and knocking on doors and neighborhood this and neighborhood that. Let's see churches filling pews with babies. That would be fantastic. And again, not everyone can have children, and, you know, there's all that stuff. But you know, if it's a general statement to the church, church, go have a bunch of babies. That would be fantastic. That's the first three reasons. The fourth, because we're running out of time here, is the preventing uncleanness. So this is obviously a biblical euphemism for not having premarital sex. Is this enough reason for people to marry? We talked about children as one of the reasons. Is preventing uncleanness enough of a reason for a couple to marry?
Well, I think that there's, and this might be a little nuanced or maybe reading in, I'm not sure the biblical parameters of uncleanness are simply physical. And I think we can downplay lust in our reality here in our 21st century America, where kind of, you know, as Jesus taught, you know, you've heard it said, don't have sex outside of marriage. And some people, it's like almost anything goes, as long as it's not, you know, traditional sexual act. As long as you're not doing that, then you're okay. And I think we really downplay lust and need to even take lust into account in this reason for marriage, because, you know, lust is something that just burns and destroys and can cause, you know, unfruitfulness in a lot of ways in one's life. And so I think it is a legitimate reason to marry. But, you know, still understanding that you're marrying for life, you know, this isn't just to get you through the next few years. This is to help take care of you. So
absolutely. You know, that people treat marriage sometimes like a silver bullet, like it's going to kill my lust. And you actually carry your lustful heart into your marriage. And so, you know, having the gospel applied to the sin of lust before marriage is so significantly important. And so that being the case, I would just say, you know, there's a lot, yeah, there's a lot more to articulate than just simply, hey, if you're lusting, you should get married.
All right. Any pastoral advice on the whole paragraph? I mean, we've woven some pastoral advice through it, and we've seen a couple of different approaches to pastoral advice here. But any pastoral advice for these four purposes that are together for why we ought to marry?
Well, one thing, we kind of skipped over this, I think, because of time, but advice, you know, counsel to those who are unable to have children. And it seems that for some, adoption is a really large idea, a goal, something they want to do. And it seems like for others, there's a real desire that can almost be obsession that at least one of our children needs to be from us. And all kinds of time and money and attention are spent on that. And, you know, obviously this is, I think it's a matter of conscience and how one pursues this, but don't underestimate the importance of both, really. I mean, I've heard of some people, we're not having our own kids, we're going to adopt. And, you know, so that pendulum can swing both ways. And week before last, I was back in Ohio for the funeral of a woman who was a mentor, and she and her husband were our youth leaders at our church. And she taught me about everything I know about music in my life. amazing woman. And her son, who's now in his mid-50s and was almost 10 when they adopted him as the oldest child. And at the visitation, he came up and was talking to my brother and I. And he said, you know, I still remember the day. I was right up here in the child services home on North Main Street. And I watched this woman pull up in her green station wagon and get out with a sundress on and a white purse under her arm and walk in. And I thought, she is beautiful. There's no way she's here for me. I don't deserve that. He said, I just couldn't believe it when she picked me. And I felt like I was hearing like an evangelistic presentation of how Christ, you know, invades our lives and takes us home. Do not undervalue in any way the importance you can have in the life of a child. And I think we need to encourage one another as well. There can be a great fear of adopting a child who's over a certain age. And there's this huge black hole in child services in our country of those kids who have, they've aged out. They're no longer attractive because they're not going to be cute and bring diapers with them and all of that. And there's massive gospel opportunity to create legitimate seed, godly seed in the church through adoption. So don't be afraid to pursue that and talk to your pastor, talk to your elders, and, you know, receive the encouragement and advice that you need.
Yeah, and if you'd like to think more about that theologically, we did do an episode on the doctrine of adoption as well.
All right. Well, guys, we have four reasons here. Mutual help. We have the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue. We have the increase of the church with a holy seed. And we have the preventing of uncleanness. These are the reasons that that we have marriage, and these are the things that we should be promoting in our churches and in our communities as reasons for getting married. Guys, always good time talking with you, and thank you for joining in the conversation today, and thank you, listeners, for joining in as well as we work our way to the end of the Confession of Faith, which says, "Come, Lord Jesus, come quickly. Amen."
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Jerusalem Chamber. To become a full subscriptionist, head over to iTunes and subscribe to this podcast. Visit us at JerusalemChamber.com or drop us an email at thejerusalemchamber@gmail.com. The Jerusalem Chamber is copyrighted 2019.